Great. Thank you, Kathy, and thanks everyone for being here. I know it's late in the afternoon, and we're all hoping to get outside in the sun soon. But hopefully this will be interesting enough that everyone will be energized and awake. So as Kathy said, my name's Wyatt Benskin, and I'm with the National Park Service Office of Public Health. And today I'll be talking a little bit, or a lot of it, about the results from a multi-jurisdictional pilot that we were involved with looking at travel history. So as I'm sure we all know, travel history is a pretty standard component of most notifiable disease investigations. A patient's travel history can aid in multiple parts of the investigation, including identifying the exposure, linking cases, and detecting clusters. I think when we talk about travel history, what first comes to mind is significant international travel or large travel. But the reality is any out-of-jurisdiction travel can aid in the investigation, whether that be the next city over, the next county over, or even just the state. So there are two recent outbreaks that really underscore the importance of travel history in epidemiology. The first example here was an outbreak of hantavirus at Yosemite National Park between June and August of 2012. This particular example, travel history was key because they were able to connect the patients to these tent cabins shown in the photos here, which is where the rodent exposure occurred. So without that patient's travel history and knowledge that they were in Yosemite Park and stayed overnight here, this issue at the park facilities wouldn't have been known. The second example that really highlights travel history is, I'm sure we're all aware, the measles at the two Disney theme parks outbreak that occurred between December 2014 and February of 2015. A patient's travel was really key here because of the size of the outbreak and how there were patients from 8 states, Mexico, and Canada. So travel history is not without its challenges. So the biggest challenge is that it does vary between jurisdiction. And this variation can be seen in the level of detail in how it's collected in categorical or free text questions, as well as just different incubation periods and travel windows used. Additionally, we see often that travel history is kind of collected as a secondary piece of information. So there'll be questions about exposure, for example, place where a tick bite likely occurred. And through that, we learn a lot about travel history, but it's never really asked up front. So there are some efforts looking at this issue, data harmonization being a big one of them. So with this variation, there are efforts at the CDC to align and harmonize different surveillance variables, and this is done through the NNDSS National Modernization Initiative. So this is a good example of an effort that exists that's hoping to standardize some or harmonize some variables. So these challenges with travel history were recognized by a group of people at the 2012 CSTE annual conference. A roundtable was held to discuss travel history. And then the following January, a formal CSTE travel history work group was established. The work group was housed in the Surveillance Practice and Implementation Subcommittee and consisted of 12 members. And this was like I said, established in January of 2013. When the work group was first established, it mainly consisted of conversations and bringing in experts and really discussing travel history's place in epidemiology. And through their research, they actually found that there wasn't a lot of research about travel history and were inspired to lead their own study, which was to develop, pilot, and evaluate a standardized travel history approach. So the work group identified 20 jurisdictions that covered all 10 HHS regions that would participate in this study implementing the standardized approach. So 6 of them were from state regions or districts, and 14 were counties or cities. Once recruited, the jurisdictions were given the option to participate into up to 8 notifiable diseases. These diseases were very specifically selected from the work group, 2 waterborne and 6 vectorborne, shown here. They were selected after consultation with subject matter experts and hoped to capture both waterborne and vectorborne, so showing some variety in diseases while also keeping it fairly narrow and manageable for the work group and the pilot. So this is just a map showing the breakdown of the 20 participating jurisdictions. And one thing I'll highlight and definitely come back to in limitations is if you look in Texas, you can see that we have a very significant number. So the sites were recruited just simply based on who the work group knew, as well as with some help from some folks at NACHO. So the participants are quite limited, and that's why we have so many in Texas, was because it's simply through connections made. So the first step to the study was the collecting and analyzing the baseline case investigation forms. So these were the forms or printouts of the electronic database that was normally used in the investigations. From there, we abstracted and coded travel history fields, looking at specific travel history questions as well as exposure questions that contain travel history information. The second step was really the big part of the project, and that was implementing a pilot form to all 20 jurisdictions. The jurisdictions were asked to use the pilot form in place of the traditional form for all cases reported between April 1st and October 31st of 2014. So this is the form, and I just want to take a few moments to talk through it a little bit. So this was completely developed by the work group, and what you see on the screen here is the lower half of the form. So the top half was the very standard demographic information, but this is really where the work group focused most of the energy. So working down the form, the first thing that I'd like to point out is the work group chose not to standardize the incubation period. So part of that variation that we talked about as a challenge with travel history was still in the study because jurisdictions were using the same incubation period that they would normally use. So the first question they were asked was a travel history specific question, and that is if they traveled outside the county of residence, excluding travel for commuting. So if they answered yes to that, they were then asked travel to other states and then travel internationally. In each of these situations, it was a categorical answer, yes, no, or unknown, followed by a detailed table to fill in the free text information. And then the lower half of this was designed, like I said, by the work group, and this was the place-based exposures. So the work group for the 8 diseases that they were studying chose these 4 categories to specifically ask about. The first one was parks or other public lands. Second was beaches, lakes, pools, or other recreational water sources. Third was festivals or county and state fairs. And fourth was other large public gatherings. So these 4 were chosen based on, as I mentioned, the diseases. And the idea was that this section of the standardized form could be customized based on other diseases and whether or not these 4 categories were relevant or not. And again, another what I'd like to highlight here is that each one was supposed to be asked individually as a categorical question with yes, no, or unknown, and then provided a free text slot to be able to fill that information in. And then so the third part of the study was just a post-intervention survey to all jurisdictions and all investigators who participated. And so data analysis was done using Microsoft Access, Excel, and Stata, and IRB approval from the University of New Mexico. So starting to get into the results here, these were the results from the analysis of the baseline case forms. And a couple things, so we received 64 unique forms for all 8 diseases, and we found that just under 80% of forms had at least one travel history question. So looking at the table here, a couple things stand out. So first and foremost, we had 18 jurisdictions participating with cryptosporidiosis and 11 participating with giardiasis. And as you see on the table, for crypto, we received 15 unique forms, and for giardiasis, we received 10 unique forms. So out of 11 jurisdictions participating, we had 10 unique forms, showing that there was essentially no overlap across jurisdictions in using the forms. That wasn't as true for the vector-borne forms, but it still did show some of the variation. So looking at the travel history questions, the mean numbers you see here and the ranges given are the addition of a categorical and a free text question. So we added those numbers. So if a question was, did you travel? Yes, no, that was counted as 1. And then if it said, please describe, in an empty space, that was also counted as 1. So the highest number of that we saw, or the highest mean we saw, was with West Nile virus at 2.45 questions. And the lowest was Lyme disease at 1.33. So it didn't even have the full 2 one free text, one categorical. And I'd like to keep that Lyme disease number in mind because I think it will come back up here in a minute. So we received 609 cases from our 20 jurisdictions using the pilot form. So of those that were confirmed, probable, or suspect, 97.5% were confirmed or probable, showing that a good majority of the cases we were working with were real cases of the diseases. We saw a median of 12 cases per jurisdiction with a pretty big range of 2 to 201. We saw most jurisdictions reporting a small number of cases, but those states we had participating really provided a lot of data. Not surprisingly, about 62% of our cases were the two waterborne diseases. Nothing really shocking there, but it's also worth noting that we had fairly low numbers of babesiosis, tularemia, and ehrlichiosis. Again, not terribly surprising, but just goes to show the breakdown of the cases we received. Additionally, a third of the cases came from counties or cities, and two-thirds from state regions or districts. So this was the real meat of the project and what we were looking to get at, and this was the travel questions. So out of the 609 cases, 40.5% of them reported out of county travel, about 30% reported out of state, and 10% reported international. I think all three of those numbers are pretty significant. We also saw that the 40.5% of all cases was true between waterborne and vectorborne diseases, so 40.4 and 40.8, so there wasn't a huge discrepancy there, showing that travel history was common across both categories. And the one thing I'd like to point out here is that one of the highest percentage of travel history questions was Lyme disease at 51.6%. We had one number higher, well, two, but the case numbers were quite low. But with Lyme disease, I thought this was particularly interesting because we saw over half of Lyme disease cases reporting travel history. And if you remember from the original table, the average on Lyme disease standard case or baseline case report forms was only 1.33. So the disease where we saw the most travel in the current approach had the fewest questions on the case forms. So this was the place-based exposure categories, the lowest half of the form. So as we kind of can see across all four categories, the overwhelming answer is no. But we did have a significant number of cases in each category reporting yes, specifically almost 20% in parks or other public lands and 27% indoor-outdoor water sources. What I think was a little shocking when looking at the data is that this unknown or missing category was pretty significant throughout, the lowest being 18% all the way up to 25%. So that meant for water, for recreational water exposure, a quarter of the cases, that information was either listed as unknown or it was completely missing from what we received. So I think it's interesting when we saw the percentage of cases that were traveling, but there was still a lot of missing data. Onto the post-intervention survey. So we saw the breakdown of those who completed the post-intervention survey being very similar to the jurisdictions we had participating. We saw one-third of them state, region, or district, and two-thirds county or city, so that aligned well with our the breakdown of jurisdictions. We saw a significant number of years in public health. What I think is particularly interesting about job title is we saw just under half were epidemiologists, but we also saw almost 31% were public health nurses, as well as these other categories of individuals who are actively conducting investigations. And I did forget to mention we had quite a number of responses, but these 52 were only those who actually participated. So all of these numbers are those who participated in our standardized approach. And what I think is interesting about job title is it goes to show the variety of individuals actively conducting case investigations in jurisdictions. And so looking and talking about a standardized approach, it's not just standard, so all the data that migrates up looks the same, but it's even within a jurisdiction, having multiple people from multiple backgrounds conducting investigations. If you standardize the way travel history is asked, it can ensure that cases within, or sorry, data within a jurisdiction can be easily comparable. So of our 52 respondents, the overwhelming majority, 92%, agreed or strongly agreed that the standardized questions were easy to implement. Similarly, 71% said that it helped them develop a standardized approach. Just under 60% said that the standardized questions should continue to be used, 27% for only certain diseases. And I think this was something we definitely wanted to look at because we wanted to see if it was really feasible to implement these standardized questions, and we wanted to see, is this a doable thing? And so that's also why we asked about the median time. We found that the median time to ask the standardized questions was reported as 5 minutes. We saw a big range from half a minute to 90 minutes. I think the 90 minutes was a significant outlier, and it was the only one, so we wonder if maybe they typed it wrong or misunderstood the question, but for the sake of good data, I included it. So we saw most people saying 5 to 10 minutes, so obviously not a heavy burden, and most people agreed that it was easy to implement. Just two selected quotes that I'd like to show. The first one says that it didn't add any information that wasn't being collected, but provided a formal reporting tool for travel history. So I think this connects well to the beginning where we said, you know, travel history is a fairly common thing that comes out in investigations, but currently there's not really a formal way of recording this. And the second person said it was a great way to capture accurate and relevant data. So again, overwhelmingly, people thought it was great, and even though it maybe didn't add new information, it at least helped the investigation. So in summary, baseline case forms showed marked variability. Out-of-county travel was fairly common with over 40% across diseases, and standardized travel questions had a high acceptability and were fairly easy to implement. So the limitations were that it was not generalizable for all notifiable diseases. Travel history is in no way a one-size-fits-all approach, and that's why I took a moment earlier to mention that lowest half of the form, those place-based exposures, can be and should be modified based on what's actually relevant to the disease in question. So talking about travel history, it in no way is going to be an easy solution saying, here's the new questions, let's include them, but it's really thinking about what information we need. Again, I mentioned that median number of 12 cases per jurisdiction. So issues with the sample size and the distribution of jurisdictions. And we don't really know if the tool was able to elicit more information because we didn't do pre- and post-intervention data collection to see, are we getting more information? So the implications and next steps, I think it goes without saying that definitely more travel history studies are needed. So looking at other notifiable diseases, other categories of diseases. Also, a good point for discussion is what information in travel history actually needs to be passed from the local to the state level. I don't have the answer for that. I don't think anyone does. But looking at the data we received in this standardized format, how much of that should be passed on versus how much can remain at the local level. Looking at how travel history fields can be built into electronic surveillance systems and looking at tools for cluster detection. And again, both of these points go back to highlight the fact that we're looking or talking about categorical versus free text questions. Currently, I don't think there's a good way to analyze free text. Maybe one day the computer software can do all of that, and that would be amazing. But finding ways to work in more categorical questions that can be easily analyzed. So travel history is increasingly relevant. In the past couple years, we saw with Ebola and all the travel scare around that. But in the coming months, with potential Zika outbreaks, a patient's travel history will be really vital to understanding declaring if Zika is in a county or not. Because again, if that individual is frequently visiting the next county over, that may not mean you have Zika in your county if that's where they reported. So also with the CDC NMI, as that's moving forward, looking at data harmonization efforts and maybe finding ways that travel history can be built into this. And this last point, I think, is particularly interesting. So this project was a huge undertaking, involved 20 jurisdictions, and it was all done based on volunteer time. So there was no funding for this project. No one was getting paid to do this. And there was no incentive for the jurisdictions other than adding to the research and wanting to be, you know, productive contributors in these conversations. So looking at developing some sort of multi-jurisdictional research network where health departments could sign up. So looking in the future then, if you wanted to rerun this study, you would have a much easier way to create a more robust survey sample that would be, you know, that you wouldn't have so many jurisdictions in one area and wouldn't rely on just who you happen to know, but it would allow smaller jurisdictions to see the studies that are being done and really be able to participate. And I think that would really, you know, make all the research being done even better. So lots of acknowledgments here. Special thanks David Wong and Melissa Hawkins, two mentors of mine, as well as Sarah Lathrop, Meredith Lichtenstein, CSTE, for hosting the Travel History Workgroup and bringing me here to present. The CSTE Travel History Workgroup, the 20 participating jurisdictions, our friends at NACHO, and everyone on this slide and many more, lots of people. But this is everyone really who implemented our standardized approach across these 20 jurisdictions, and there's more people who aren't on here that I know you know, we're willing to give something new a try with, you know, like I said, nothing in it for them. So thank you very much, and I'll take a couple questions if I have time.
Earlier today, I was at a roundtable on the binational variable. And I'm sure you know a little bit about that. Others in the audience might not know quite as much as you do. But I wonder how much what you've been doing overlaps with what they've been doing and whether there's, well, to be concrete about it, was there someone from CDC's Division of Migration and Quarantine and probably garbled the title of the division, but at any rate, they are clearly at the CDC side leading the binational variable work. And part of the conversation was about message mapping guides. And I noticed that part of your conversation was about message mapping guides. It seems like, you know, you guys ought to be talking together. So can you comment on that?
I'm not as familiar with that. And there were two individuals at CDC on the work group. I'm not familiar with their background. So I'm not sure. I guess so this study was just done very voluntary through the work group, as I mentioned. And it's taken quite a while to put the results together. So I'm sorry I don't have a better answer for that. Sorry. Any other questions? Great. All right. Thank you.